This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, the thing about history is that it's settled until it isn't. Take the Washington Redskins football team name.
Hail to the Redskins.
Sounds fine until it's not. And a debate of its offensiveness to Native Americans is now in play, along with passes and kickoffs this football season. How about slavery? Emancipation settled that. Not quite. Even after the Civil Rights Movement, we are still dealing with the consequences of slavery.
When I introduced the legislation in 1989, it was the first time we'd ever asked the federal government to do something about it, the legislature. And whether there should be an apology, or could there be, or should there be an apology, and what form our reparations would take.
Michigan Congressman John Conyers is not the only lawmaker to bring up the question of slave reparations for people whose lives were destroyed during the period when slavery was legal. And it's a debate now among Caribbean nations for whom extreme poverty has persisted since the European slave trade. 14 nations from a group known as CARICOM are now in the process of asking former colonial powers of Britain, France, and the Netherlands to pay reparations for the centuries of damage they inflicted through slavery and racism. One of the voices hoping to have standing, perhaps even in the International Criminal Court of Justice in The Hague, is Stacey Ann Chin, a Jamaican-American writer and activist who lived in Jamaica until she was 24 years old. Welcome, Stacey Ann.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
So how is the argument for compensation, for call it what you will, some recognition of the devastation in the CARICOM nations from the slave trade, how is that debate taking place in your country?
I think that there are a number of ways that people expect there to be some kind of compensation. I think that the damage remains national in those spaces. And, you know, if we reference the conversations around what happened in Germany with the Jewish community and how it is that people have compensated those descendants of the Jews who were either killed or tortured, you know, under the Hitler regime, I think that people don't necessarily give out checks or hand out money in that kind of way. But I do believe that there needs to be some acknowledgement. And I think that here is where the crux of the argument lies, in the fact that people need an apology, they need acknowledgement of what happened, and they need the acknowledgement of how it has affected them generation after generation after generation. And I don't think that the people in the Caribbean are necessarily asking for monies or checks or coins to be given over, but it is apparent that the vestiges of slavery remain with regard to education, with regard to its ability to produce, to be a thriving economic nation in the global economy. There needs to be something that levels the playing field globally.
How would you describe visually the vestiges of slavery in Jamaica? How do they manifest themselves when you're driving through your town? What is it that you see that absolutely reminds you of the impact of the slave trade?
You know, it doesn't look very much different from what it looks like globally in terms of what slavery has done. The power hierarchy set up in most of those nations very much resemble the color hierarchy that was in place when slavery was in place. The lighter skinned you are, the more opportunity you have, the more power you have, the more opportunities you have to pursue your own happiness, your own passions, your own desires. Your children get to go off to, you know, college and high school. They get to own homes. The majority of the population, the poor population, tends to look not very different from the slave population in terms of phenotype. You know, the darker skinned people are still at the bottom of the economic ladder.
So what's your guess? Can the lawyers pull this off in some sense?
I think that it's something that has to happen. I'm not sure how it will happen, and I'm not sure if it will happen in my lifetime. But I know that these lawyers, these people, they have a valid position from which to ask for such a thing, because things are owed to people when large organizations, be they governments or otherwise, take advantage of a nation. And when it goes on for 500 years, I do believe that some compensation is, it's a no-brainer that people should be given the opportunity at least to reap some of the benefits the labor of their ancestors provided for those who enjoy them now.
Stacey Ann Chin, Jamaican-American writer and activist who lived in Jamaica until she was 24 years old. Stacey Ann, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
The argument by the lawyers is not quite a no-brainer. Lawyers representing the 14 Caribbean nations will have to prove more than just the proposition that slavery was and is abhorrent. The British government stipulates that already, but it adds in a statement, "We do not see reparations as the answer. Instead, we should concentrate on identifying ways forward with a focus on the shared global challenges that face our countries in the 21st century." Shared global challenges would seem to fall short of any monetary damages, at least from the British perspective. But attorney Martin Day says there may be a body of evidence to show the impact of slavery holding back Caribbean nations even today. Day is a senior partner at Lee Day, the British law firm litigating on behalf of the Caribbean countries.
Obviously, if this was a kind of minor issue, a property dispute between nations or whatever, 300-500 years would be miles too long to ever contemplate bringing such a claim. I think what one is really saying here is that the scale of the damage, the scale of the outrage that occurred during that 300-400 year period is so enormous that it can't just be pushed to one side, it can't just be pushed under the carpet. And it is an issue that obviously massively rankles still within the Caribbean.
What are the precedents here in international law in terms of, say, the Aboriginal population in Australia, the explicit sort of seeking of damages by groups from either the countries they're in or other countries?
Well, we've seen over the last 10, 15 years a whole series of cases around the world where groups of individuals who've been impacted usually by very severe treatment. So, for example, we represented the Mau Mau, a group of Kenyans who were tortured by the British during the colonial era back in the 1940s and 50s, and we were able to successfully claim compensation for a group of about 5,000 of them. We succeeded in that just earlier this year. But there are other examples in the States. There was compensation paid to the Japanese who were interred during the course of the Second World War. There have been obviously large payouts in relation to what happened during the Holocaust era to the Jews by the German government and German industry. Usually these periods are like 50 or 60 years, so well beyond any sort of limitation period that in any of these countries. But also I'm not suggesting that they're anything like as long as the 200-400 years that we're talking about with slavery.
And there's the question of illegality and the moving target of culture. I mean, I'm not saying that there is anything less than an absolute value of human life, regardless of race. But there certainly was a time in the world where people didn't view other people this way, and that some people were had a little more standing than animals.
And that's obviously very fair in the sense of, you know, it was a terrible chapter of history for many of the nations in terms of what was done at the time. But I think the crucial thing here is that we here in Britain, we built our Industrial Revolution on the back of much of what was going on within the slave trade. So although it was legal in a formal sense here in Britain, you know, we were, as a country, were growing rich at the behest of all these millions of slaves taken from West Africa to the Caribbean. And, you know, you just have to go and talk to people, and it is still an issue that massively rankles and has had the most significant impact on them as a group, as a group of nations. You go to West Africa, you get exactly the same feeling. So I think it is our duty, moral, but I think also we have a good argument, legal, to say to the Caribbean, look, you know, if you are still suffering as a result of what we did all those years ago, then there is a real duty on the British people, the British government, to try and resolve it.
What's the counter-argument here? I mean, you could say that you're opening the door to lawsuits on the belated recognition of monotheism as a principle of humanity, or a belated recognition of vegetarianism as a principle of humanity. And certainly one could go to places in the world and see the horrible impacts of eating animal flesh all over the world and file lawsuits on that basis.
Well, I think that's slightly trivializing, if I may say, John. You know, that here we're talking about millions of people who were treated like absolute dirt and that the repercussions all these centuries later still remain. They have not gone away. And I think that for Britain, for France, for the Netherlands, for other Western European states, even the United States itself, that to try and just kind of push it to one side and say, well, look, life's just moved on, why don't you guys move on as well? Well, the reality is they haven't. And I think it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed now.
I agree with you that it needs to be addressed, but the argument in court will be exactly that. Look, we've moved on. It's time to move on here. What is the counter legal argument to say, no, you have to stop what you're doing and deal with this now, even beyond the significance of the humanitarian problems that you've described in those individual nations?
Well, I think what we would be trying to explain to the court, and, you know, I'm not saying for a single second that this is going to be the easiest legal case we've ever had to deal with. But, you know, what we would be saying to the court is to explain to them the significance of what happened here today in 2013, and to explain to those judges in front of us how the importance of being able to move on for not just the Caribbean, but for the Western powers as well. And that legally, albeit that all these years have gone past, that they should use their discretion to enable these claims to be properly brought and to be properly resolved, in the same way that, as I say, in our Mau Mau case, the Kenyan case, the judge, who's normally got 3 years in terms of the limitation period in the UK, was prepared to exercise his discretion to say 50, 60 years was not too long.
Which is more important, the principle here or the actual dollar amount of reparations in the end?
I think both of them are very significant. I think there is a real importance in these sort of cases, and one sees it in the Caribbean, that they need to see victory, they need to see justice is being done and seem to be done. But at the same time, the money will be crucial as well, is that they are nations with living in a lot of poverty, and if they can manage to get some serious money out of the Western countries, then that would enable them to kind of move on as well in terms of their own economic and financial positions. So I think it's a mixture of the two.
What is serious money in this case?
Too early to tell you. You know, quite genuinely, these are early days. We've got a lot of work to do as to working out quite what the claim to the Western powers should be. That's perhaps a discussion for another day.
Martin Day, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Day is senior partner at Lee Day, the British law firm litigating on behalf of the Caribbean countries for reparations for the slave trade.
Hey, take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
World Series kicks off tonight. Boston Red Sox, St. Louis Cardinals. Who are you rooting for?
Oh, this is Ricky Vassallo. I live in Largo, Florida. And, of course, I'm rooting for the Redbirds in St. Louis. My wife is from St. Louis. Reason enough.
Well, she's happy. Anyone not happy in your household? It's a smackdown discussion between St. Louis and Boston over this World Series. Join it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Play ball.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
And now, how do we evaluate the severity of the problems in the rollout of the Affordable Care Act? Prospective consumers refreshing their browsers and hoping that their confidential health information makes it into the right hands, hoping the screen doesn't freeze up or crash altogether.
We want new eyes and ears. We want to make sure that we get all the questions on the table, that we get all the answers, and accelerate the fix as quickly as possible.
That's a beleaguered Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius speaking on CNN. This enrollment may have problems, but it is the most comprehensive change to federal health care policy since President Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid into law back in 1965. And there have been other programs that have taken a while to get up and running. Can we compare this ACA situation to other federal beta tests of yore? Joining us is Helen Levy, Research Associate Professor at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and former senior economist to President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Helen, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Is there any objective way to evaluate rollouts of this kind, independent of technology, that have involved different social classes, various kinds of enrollment documents, and specific requirements to determine whether people get subsidies or not? I'm thinking of the prescription drug program that was rolled out during the Bush administration. And then there are, of course, the huge rollouts of Medicare and Medicaid.
That's right. I think the experience with Medicare Part D, the prescription drug program that was rolled out in 2006, does provide a lot of useful comparisons to what's happening now. So then, as now, there were embarrassing technical glitches that happened with the website. And one thing that happened then was for the enrollees who were getting transitioned from Medicaid, the program for low-income people, into Medicare Part D plans, that handoff got bungled. And so a lot of them actually had interrupted access to their prescription drugs, which is a serious problem.
Now, there's something about the population there that would encourage them to stick with it. They know the drugs they need. They know that eventually they'll get help paying for them. And they know that medically they need to pay attention to this sort of thing. With healthy people having the same kinds of problems trying to get onto the exchanges for the Affordable Care Act, what is the worry that people just sort of give up and never go back?
Well, that's right. You've put your finger on, you know, exactly what the concern here is, which is basically that for the exchanges to work, we need healthy people to enroll. And you want to make, you know, the logistical hurdles that people have to go through as low as possible so that you don't get only the sick people who are really dedicated to getting insurance. And so what remains to be seen, I guess, is whether the people who were really intent on signing up right at the outset, who will have been put off by this, by the obstacles that the website has thrown before them unexpectedly in these first few weeks, whether those people were the people who are dedicated and whether the healthy people are still going to sign up once they get the kinks worked out because they were waiting anyway, we'll just have to wait and see.
And what would be the kind of emergency measures that would be brought in here? I suspect under Part D, the prescription drug program, there had to be additional outreach to make sure that people's hands were held during the process. In this particular case, could you subcontract out software that would get people where they are, young people in the Targets and the Starbucks of the world, where they can, hey, sign up really easily, the way that you can get a flu shot almost by, you know, hopping in a taxi?
Yeah, that's a good question. I will say that in the case of Part D, they did have their own tech surge. They brought on thousands more people in their call center at the Medicare 1-800 number that they were relying on heavily. And the other thing that happened in Part D was the states, which after all had been running the Medicaid programs for those people who were having the problems, the states stepped up and said to the pharmacies and the insurers, look, we're going to cover this. Okay, so give these people their drugs. Now, it's not as obvious in this situation sort of who is poised to step up and do something about this. And I'm not a technology person, so I sort of don't know what technologically you can do to fix these problems. But certainly, you know, continuing to do the kind of outreach they've been doing to younger, healthy people would be an important part of it.
And if we remember back to these rollouts of the past, and you're very familiar with all of them, I mean, it seems to me the end of the story, however many difficulties there were in the beginning period, is pretty much the same, that the program gets up and running, the errors get worked out, the catastrophes get rectified on some level, and then the program becomes seen as absolutely essential. That was certainly the case with Part D, and do you expect that will be the case with the Affordable Care Act, or does it have unique problems that might derail it?
Well, I think that the risk with the exchanges is that you sort of in the early years, if you drive away the healthy people, then instead of having sort of a functioning exchange where it's for everybody, you basically have a high risk pool. Now, the reason I'm optimistic that that's not going to happen and that we will have a story like with Part D, because you're right when you say now everybody's like, well, this is really a great success and people have mostly forgotten all these problems. The reason I think that we're going to have that same success with the exchanges is that the value of the subsidized coverage that people can get in the exchange. It's just too good a deal to turn it down because you couldn't get into the website the first time you went to register. So even if you're a young, relatively healthy person, there are generous subsidies to make insurance affordable for people. And I think that that's going to be what makes people get past these problems, do what they have to do. And I do think people will sign up. And the 5 years from now, we'll be saying, you know, just like with Part D, we're going to be saying there were some glitches at the rollout, but now it works and we all really like it.
So time and a certain word of mouth for people who really enjoy the coverage that they get is going to prevent the kind of Fox News catastrophes that we're hearing about every day.
I think that's right, but I think it may be a little while before we get there. So I would say let's wait 3 years and see how things are going then.
All right, 3 years. Helen Levy is Research Associate Professor at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, former senior economist to the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Helen, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is sponsored by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. In theaters October 18th.
It's a tale of two cities today, St. Louis and Boston. The team stories you already know if you're a baseball fan getting ready for the World Series. For the Red Sox, it's been the worst of times very recently.
I feel very strongly that we found the right person in Bobby Valentine.
I understand how difficult this was.
And so this best of times feels particularly great for Boston.
This Red Sox team plays with a lot of heart.
Boston Mayor Tom Menino there. For St. Louis, 2 years after winning the World Series, the worst of times is rare for this powerhouse team. Right, designated hitter Alan Craig?
We have a decent amount of guys here from that team, but we have a lot of new guys.
That level of excitement is definitely still here.
Our mission here is to pit two cities against each other in another kind of World Series. Two takeaway communities facing off, one city by the rivers.
Meet me in St. Louis.
Of course, the first meeting in the World Series will not be in St. Louis. It will be in Boston, the city by the bay, where we hopefully won't have to hear this song very much. Boston, the 70s rock band named by a geek from MIT, Tom Scholz, who invented stuff for Polaroid. Boston, the city, was named by Puritans in the 1600s, who invented sitting quietly and doing nothing for hours except reading the Bible and occasionally burning girls as witches. St. Louis, named for a French king, Louis IX, who was sainted despite failing to retake the Holy Land from Muslim rulers and getting plague in the process.
Have we turned into gerbils, ladies and gentlemen? People are paying money to go into a health club and walk up invisible steps over and over again for an hour and a half. Where are you going?
Oh, I've never had pains like this before. Oh, this is the worst one I ever had, son. You hear that, Elizabeth? I'm coming to join you, honey.
The personalities of comedians Red Fox from St. Louis and Dennis Leary of Boston give you a sense of the contrasts here. Jazz legend Miles Davis came from East St. Louis, where the Red Foxes of the world dreamed of crossing the river and joining the working class. Miles made it. So did working-class Aerosmith, the Bad Boys of Boston's segregated neighborhood, Southie, Charlestown, left Boston far behind in the 80s and 90s, and still today. And while here's the sound of that highly cultured and educated crowd in Harvard, Yard, and MIT, and the other list of colleges who rejected you years ago, Yo-Yo Ma, Emmanuel Ax, and the somber Beethoven cello sonatas. You might say St. Louis has an infield answer to that.
Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news.
Chuck Berry, the classic rocker. Both cities produce nice stuff that people don't fully understand why it's there. That huge stainless steel gateway arch in St. Louis must be good for something. Drying laundry. And Michael McDonald is well-meaning. A song for all the toasted ravioli you can eat. While Boston has that weird obelisk in Charlestown where you might not want to go at night by yourself, and if you do get lost, then just hope that Ben Affleck and Jeremy Renner don't find you. Much better the kindly James Taylor takes you.
Even the old folks never knew why they call it like they do.
Just the kind of music for enjoying a local chowder. As for the World Series, it's hard to know which team has the edge here. We're counting on you to give us some insight.
The entire Red Sox organization exemplifies the spirit of what baseball represents in this country. Also, let's face it, the beards are fantastic.
But we'll leave you now with St. Louis gospel legend, the late Willie Mae Ford Smith, who has a direct line to the big upstairs.
I'll keep on till I reach the other shore.
The Cards, I think, may start with a leadoff man on base tonight. Spiritually speaking. To the Middle East now. The most recent international tension over Syria ended for now with diplomacy and the signing of Syria to the International Chemical Weapons Conventions and a process for dismantling chemical weapons arsenals in Syria. The civil war continues, however, sadly. But it also resulted in some surprising cooperation between the U.S. and Russia, and perhaps most surprising of all, a warming of tone between the U.S. and Iran. This has made Israel predictably nervous, and statements from the Israeli government reflect this. But what has been less predictable is how Saudi Arabia's relationship with the U.S. may have been affected. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Saudi officials in Paris this week and acknowledged the difficulties in a statement to reporters in London yesterday.
We know that the Saudis were obviously disappointed that the strike didn't take place, and it's our obligation to work closely with them, as I am doing.
Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi intelligence chief, says his country will be making a major shift in relations with Washington and reportedly deliver that message to Secretary of State Kerry in light of what Riyadh sees as a misguided Middle East strategy. Joining me now is Carol Murphy, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of A Kingdom's Future, Saudi Arabia Through the Eyes of Its 20-somethings. Carol, welcome back to the show.
Hello, John.
So is this about the strike not taking place with the Saudis, or is this about a sense of being marginalized a little bit in all of this diplomacy that's taking place?
Well, I think the recent comments from the Saudis and their decision or their announcement of their decision last week not to take their UN seat are all meant as a message to Washington that they're deeply upset with the direction of U.S. policies. But it's not just simply the fact that the U.S. declined to bomb Damascus over its use of chemical weapons last August, and it's not just about the possibility of a new rapprochement between Washington and Tehran. It's a buildup of many other things, too. For example, the Saudis have been deeply upset. They were deeply upset about the U.S. invasion of Iraq because they feared it would lead to the mayhem that we see now and give Iran an opening into the Arab world. And then more recently, they were upset by the U.S. response to Egypt's revolution and the U.S. decision to accept the ousting of President Mubarak, a longtime ally of the United States. And the Saudis saw this as a possibly something that might happen to them in the future if the U.S. could abandon Mubarak after he'd been such a long, close friend. What would they do if a similar situation erupted in the kingdom? So I think it's a buildup of many things, and we just have to wait to see what will happen next. I'm sure that Washington is going to make extra efforts to calm the Saudi jitters.
Now, the Saudis, of course, have some levers to pull, certainly in the oil market. And what about in the cooperative arrangements that so far seem to have been fairly smooth between the Saudis and the U.S. in the drone war that seems to be going on in Yemen?
Yes, counterterrorism is a major part of this relationship, and it's important to both sides. And they have seen eye to eye on many activities in the fight against al-Qaeda. I don't think that cooperation will be upset by the new Saudi feelings of annoyance at U.S. policies. I think that the counterterrorism aspect will continue unabated.
Can the Saudis in any sense veto or slow down a U.S. rapprochement with Iran, a change in tone, if it results in greater influence in the region, something the Saudis have been steadfastly against?
I don't think that the Saudis are in a position to slow down any such rapprochement. And we must be careful to see that the possibility of that rapprochement is still a very big if. But what Washington can do is just be much more assertive and aggressive about telling the Saudis that any rapprochement with Iran could work to the Saudis' benefit in the long run, because that rapprochement won't happen without an Iranian promise not to develop a capability to build a nuclear weapon.
And if that kind of tone doesn't take place between the U.S. and the Saudi Arabia, we could see oil prices spike for one reason or another. Carol Murphy, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
Carol Murphy is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of A Kingdom's Future, Saudi Arabia Through the Eyes of Its 20-somethings.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Saudi Arabia would under no circumstances want the regional situation in the Middle East to go back to the 1970s when the U.S. and Iran were allies. Saudi Arabia was something of a second fiddle oil player back then, and its role in the Arab world was limited by the larger Arab countries of Iraq and Egypt. No one expects that situation to emerge once again, but most people in Iran today have no memory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution and were born after the reign of the Shah Pahlavi. What they know is an isolated Iran supporting insurgent movements in the world whose leaders are shunned by the West and defiantly claim they have a right to nuclear weapons. James Buchan fell in love with Iranian culture as a student more than a half century ago. He says the people of Iran today seem hungry for alternatives to the isolation of the Islamic Republic, the passion over which has long since died out. James Buchan is the author of a new book entitled Days of God: The Revolution of Iran and Its Consequences.
The monarchy in Iran, which lasted until the revolution of 1979, wasn't up to much, but it certainly compared very favorably with the Islamic Republic that's followed it. In contrast, the monarchy seems like a golden age of prosperity and justice. And it's the fact that the standard of living in the Islamic Republic has now fallen below that of the monarchy that we're getting this turn in Iran.
Although you describe in this book how in the Shah's regime and then in a kind of yin-yang sort of relationship post-revolution, the governments of Iran have delivered a bludgeon to tradition, enforcing modernism and then enforcing anti-modernism in ways that the people have no choice but simply to accept. And it's been a wild ride for Iranians really since the 1950s.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I guess forced modernization doesn't work any more than forced archaization, which is what we've had under the Islamic Republic. When the Pahlavis came to power in 1925, Iran was an extremely backward country, and they both sought to bring Iran up to the level of an industrial power much too rapidly. And it was the strains of that, particularly after 1973, 1974, that produced tremendous dislocations. Really, the Iranians didn't know whether they were coming or going.
You know, the clergy after Khomeini, in a sense, made almost the exact same mistake to try to create a Sharia law utopia almost immediately, going with great, great haste, regardless of the consequences.
Yes, yes. The revolution itself was quite a civilized and relatively bloodless affair. That occurred over 1978 and 1979. But what followed afterwards was a civil war and then a foreign war when Iran was invaded by Iraq. And it was during that dreadful decade of the 1980s that Khomeini and his supporters essentially drove out all their rivals in Iran and created the Islamic Republic.
We think of the radicalism of Iran as coming from the original days of the students taking the hostages at the U.S. Embassy. But as you write in this book, in the 1980s, during the 1980s, in recounting the old Iran-Contra affair, Iran really got the bad end of all that, both in terms of where it came out diplomatically and also the consequences in the Iran-Iraq war, one of the most brutal conflicts of the 20th century.
Yes, I mean, the Islamic Republic has not been successful. It was very nearly defeated in the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, what's at stake now is the preservation of power, and that's another cause for this change in attitude that's occurred in Iran, is that the Republic itself is under threat because of its international isolation and the very poor performance of its economy.
There are so many young people in Iran today who have possibly no real memory of the revolution, even its aftermath, in many cases the Iran-Iraq war, and certainly the period of the Shah. What would you tell a young person in Iran who may be asking you, what was it like years ago in my country?
Well, when you go to Iran, young people do come up to you and say, what was it like under the monarchy in the days of the Shah? Is it true that whiskey flowed in fountains and all the girls wore miniskirts? And I have to say, no, it wasn't like that at all. Iran was still a very, very conservative Muslim country. Obviously, the great change in the Islamic Republic is after the takeover of the U.S. embassy in November 1979, anti-Americanism became the principal pillar of state for the Islamic Republic. But anti-Americanism is not something that you come across much among ordinary Iranians. It's purely a political posture, and that is why it could be subject to change or adjustment. It's not as if the Iranian public passionately hates the United States. On the contrary, like many people all over the world, the young Iranians are enthusiastic about American culture. The problem is if the United States and Iran do bury the hatchet, then young Iranians will say, well, do we really need all these gentlemen with turbans ruling over us? Why can't we have just an ordinary common or garden parliamentary republic like everybody else? And that's why these talks in Geneva and the whole nuclear process is full of peril for the Islamic Republic.
Finally, I spent some time in Iran after 1979 and was there at the death of Ayatollah Khomeini at the end of the Iran-Iraq war after, as you write, he took the poison of compromise in the end. There was such a sense of communality, millions and millions of people in the street expressing a kind of simple reverence for all the complexity and insanity of U.S.-Iranian politics. What can you say about the beauty of that ability in Iran to just hold hands together in a way that, as an American, I just can't even imagine?
Well, Khomeini had a particular place in the heart of Iranians because he seemed to have broken out of the tragic course of Iranian history and returned the people's dignity to them. But as I say, that feeling has now entirely dissipated.
So that sense of national commonality is a moment that's passed, never to return?
Well, I don't know. It's certainly passed. I don't know whether it would return. But Iranian society has become much more fractured. What the Iranians have to be given is a way of getting out of this mess while retaining their honor and retaining their dignity. And that's neither impossible nor even particularly difficult to do.
James Buchan, author of Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Historical echoes of wrongs committed against African Americans can be heard in the stadiums of college sports, particularly football. Long after pro leagues began to integrate, the college game consisted of parallel schools, all black and all white, until a performance in 1967 changed everything forever. It all took place between the colleges of Florida A&M and at the historically black college Grambling, which is in the headlines this week for a boycott over state funding cuts that discriminated against black college students. The students have since ended their boycott after a motivational call from their fired head coach earlier this week. but it is an older story and two other coaches that have all set the stage for the transformation that took place back in 1967. Samuel Friedman is the author of the new book, Breaking the Line, The Season in Black College Football That Transformed the Sport and Changed the Course of Civil Rights.
The two coaches are Eddie Robinson at Grambling College, which is in northern Louisiana, and Jake Gaither at Florida A&M, which is in Tallahassee. Eddie Robinson is someone who probably a lot of football fans still know because he coached into the mid-90s, and he's still the all-time winningest coach in college football. Jake Gaither less so, but they're both exceptional coaches on the field, produced scorers, and in Grambling's case, better than 100 pro players. But they also were people who struggled to find a way through football to contribute something to the movement while at the same time being constrained by both the fear of physical attack because they'd grown up in an era of rampant lynchings and also constrained by the fact that the state held the purse strings on their schools. And if you stuck out, if you took a stand on civil rights, you might get fired, your students might get expelled. So what they struggled to do and eventually were able to come through on in 1967 was to do something through football to really advance the movement. In Eddie Robinson's case, he develops the first black quarterback for the NFL, James Harris. And that's significant way beyond football because the attitude about a black quarterback went at all these canards of white supremacy, that a black couldn't be smart enough, that a black couldn't be a leader, that a black couldn't really be courageous, that whites wouldn't take orders from a black. So to create that black quarterback, as he successfully did, was to really strike a number of blows against white supremacy. And in Jake Gaither's case, he was very adroitly going behind the scenes of the political class in the state of Florida to get approval to play the first black college versus white college football game in the South. And the significance of that, beyond what it means on the field, that the black team, his team, did win, is that that game becomes the largest act of desegregation of a public facility in the history of the South. A football game is the biggest mass act of desegregation since emancipation.
Did the people of Florida see that coming, and then the people of America who observed something that had happened really out of the blue?
Yes and no. I think in the South, this was followed very, very closely, that Florida A&M versus Tampa game. Nationally, less so, because it was such a different media climate at that time. No ESPN, no ubiquitous sports radio, and the white newspapers didn't cover the black colleges, even in their own backyard. So one of the great black coaches once said that black college football was played, quote, behind God's back. And so that meant that some of the effects weren't felt in the North as instantly as they were in the South. But in the South, this was a bolt of lightning.
What must it have been like to have been at that Florida game?
I've talked to people who were at it. In fact, in my book, I write about, at that point, 12-year-old white kid who goes with his father almost on a lark and realize in the middle of it that they're part of this history. Many people in the South and around the South who weren't going to take a bold stand on civil rights alone, but if they felt that they had a kind of a social permission to do it, a societal okay, their better angels were going to come out. And I think people like that took solace from this game. I'll tell you one more story, which is Jake Gaither is leaving the stadium after the game, triumphant, and he and his wife were walking to the team bus, and there are a group of white men coming in their direction. And his wife immediately says, let's change direction. She can only see in this group of men all the whites who've, you know, said terrible things or done terrible physical things to black people over the decades they've been alive. And as this group of white men get closer, they're from, I think, the Tampa Booster Club, and they go to shake Jake Gaither's hand.
Wow. Remind us of the values that these two coaches tried to instill in the students, because in many ways, education by itself was a huge escape from the poverty and the oppression of the 20th century. But these two men also felt that football had a role to play.
Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson, first of all, were terrifically well-educated men themselves. In a different era, they would have been senators, CEOs, trial lawyers, you know, you name it. And they saw the football scholarship as a way to make higher ed available to these young men they coached. And when the players got to Grambling and to Florida A&M, these coaches tracked their class attendance, tracked their grades, made sure they went to church. you know, taught them table manners, if necessary. It sounds condescending, but these were young men, especially at Grambling, who'd come out of sharecropping families, who'd had no exposure to a wider world at all. And Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither wanted every one of their players to graduate and everyone to go out and be a walking, talking advertisement for black equality, for black dignity.
The NFL could really use those values in the college programs of today.
Even more than the NFL could use them, the major colleges could use them. You know, what was so powerful and poignant and generous of Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither, selfless, is that they knew as they were pushing for the desegregation of college football in the South, they're going to lose the top players they used to get, that the big football factories, Alabama, Ole Miss, LSU, would now skim the very best black players from the South, which has happened. And their fear, and sadly it's been realized, is that at those big football factories, their players wouldn't be cared for the same way. They wouldn't be looked at as whole human beings who were there to get an education. And across the board, those major colleges have not risen to the level that Jake Gaither and Eddie Robinson set.
The biggest irony of all is perhaps in the case of Grambling, we're back to where we were decades ago, where that school right now in the headlines is fighting for equality in higher education in the state of Louisiana.
It's exactly right, John. In 1967, as I write in Breaking the Line, student protesters at Grambling used the homecoming football game as their kind of stage to protest against the racial inequalities in higher ed funding in Louisiana. And just in the past week and a half, we've had the Grambling football team boycott a game against Jackson State and get a lot of national coverage. The coverage has been, in some cases, too narrow. It's looked at it as if it's just a football issue, that their coach had been fired, that they've complaints about the quality of their facilities, that they've had to take incredibly long 1,500-mile road trips to games in buses. But what's underneath it is that that's the athletic aspect of budget cuts through the state of Louisiana that have devastated particularly a historically black school like Grambling that doesn't have a big endowment, doesn't have wealthy alumni, doesn't have all this political influence, and has been cutting faculty positions and cutting degree programs. And if these players at Grambling have brought attention to that, then they've had the ultimate championship season this year, no matter what their record is.
Well, a remarkable story that is as relevant today as it was in 1967. Samuel Friedman, Columbia journalism professor, author of Breaking the Line, the season in black college football that transformed the sport and changed the course of civil rights. Thanks as always.
Thank you, John. A real honor.
You got a piece of that story of the black civil rights movement in college football? Tell us. And what about the World Series? Got some smack talk to get off your chest? From Detroit, a fan for St. Louis because those dirty Sox beat my Tigers. Share 8778MYTAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.